Ayo Komatsu's story is fascinating. It began in Japan with his late father, who was a political prisoner during World War II, after standing up for what he believed in.
Somebody wrote a book about him, then reading that book, it's like, is this really my dad? You know, he had a gun, he was running away from the special police, and he had different name, then he was sold by the spy inside the Communist Party, that's why he got arrested, etc. First time I read it, it was like, is this really my dad's story?
At 18, Ayo moved to England to pursue a career in Formula One, and that came with its challenges.
In Japan, we don't have sarcasm, right? My landlady was very sarcastic. So after about 6 weeks, I thought she absolutely hated me. So I think we need to find a new host family. Then we decided to move. Then the day I told her, she was so upset because she actually really liked me. Later I learned, okay, that's sarcasm.
Now, with more than 20 years experience in Formula One, Ayo praises his parents for the journey that's led to his biggest opportunity so far as team principal of Haas.
I'm very, very thankful that both my mum and dad supported me to come to England to follow, you know, what I wanted to do. But I didn't show much gratitude. And then before I could repay his trust, he passed away. So I have a huge regret in many ways how I was when I was 12, 13, 14. But hopefully somewhere he's proud.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson. Ayo Komatsu has no history of motorsport in his family, so he decided to make his own. Mesmerized by the fierce rivalry between Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost during the late 80s, he set his sights on a life in Formula One from the age of 14. Now, more than three decades later, Ayo faces arguably his most exciting challenge, transforming Haas, the team that finished last in 2023, into a consistent midfield team. But how did the teenager from Tokyo get this far? From his father's ordeals as a political prisoner in Japan to his own experiences, which meant moving to a new continent in pursuit of his dream, Ayo candidly shares his remarkable story. He talks about the moment he fell in love with Formula One and how a chance meeting with Japanese F1 hero Takuma Sato led to his first job in the sport. And he shares his memories of Romain Grosjean's terrifying crash at Bahrain in 2020. And, having worked with both Fernando Alonso and Jenson Button, Ayo explains where one world champion was stronger than the other. And if that's not enough, we also discuss all things Haas, as well as his other sporting passions. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Ayo, it is lovely to have you on the show. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
When this episode comes out, you will be at Suzuka getting ready for the Japanese Grand Prix. Are you excited about racing at home?
Yeah, of course I am. Yeah. I mean, I left Japan 30 years ago, as it happens, and I never imagined I'd come back to Japan for the home Grand Prix 30 years later as a team principal. So yeah, it's of course, very excited.
How different is it going to be coming home as not only a team principal, but the first Japanese national to be leading a non-Japanese Formula One team?
Yeah, I guess it feels different. I don't know how to describe it, to be honest, but I never sort of like think too much about my nationality in that sense. But then so many people ask me what it means. So many people I spoke to when I go to Suzuka, like Japanese fans, when they ask me like, oh, you know, how did you get into Formula One? Do you think I can do it? My answer is always the same. Of course you can do it. You just have to try. You have to make that first step. Just try it, you know, without worrying about the results. So the fact that I am now, let's say, got to this position, hopefully that fact gives encouragement to all those people who are afraid to make those first steps. You know, they can look at me and say, ah, okay, if he can do it, I can do it, you know? So I hope, it serves as like an encouragement to those people.
So you left Japan in 94, aged 18.
Yeah.
What would that guy make of what you're doing now?
I guess that guy would be, I guess, pretty happy.
What was the plan when you left Japan? I mean, you went to study engineering in England?
Yeah, only plan, honestly, like when I was 13, 14, I bumped into Formula One just by coincidence, because it was very popular. It was available on TV. And then around that time, just the drama of McLaren Honda Senna versus Prost was massive. Then it became McLaren versus Ferrari. All the drama was unfolding, and I wanted to do something international. So that really hooked me into it. So from that day, I really wanted to work in Formula One. So then decided that if I wanted to work in Formula One, I better come to England.
Was there any motor racing in your family? Or when you say you bumped into Formula One, that was just on a Sunday afternoon? What's this on the TV?
Yeah, I mean, my family had nothing to do with motorsport. You know, I was the first one in the family to even have a driving license. My dad thought that learning how to drive is totally a waste of time. He said he hasn't got time or money to do it. So yeah, it was you can't be that farther away from motorsports than my family, I think. Back then, early 90s, late 80s, if you are, let's say, 11 years old, 12 years old, everybody was into motorbike. So now you are really eagerly waiting until you get to the age of 60 and get motorbike license and buy a motorbike. So even though we weren't able to ride motorbikes yet, we are all into it. So MotoGP was big. And actually my, let's say, neighbor, he later became MotoGP rider, Norik Kaveh. So we came from the same area. And then we are the same age. So I didn't know him, but I knew of him because literally he was from our next door junior high school. And he was, I think, racing in US motocross. So that was all very close to us, the motorbike racing more. Then one day, I guess I watched the Formula One race on TV. And then, wow. So for some reason, I never thought of becoming rider or driver. Then I thought, okay, if I'm going to be an engineer, I think I can better influence in car racing than motorbike racing. For some reason, I thought that. Then I thought, okay, this is what I want to do.
Let's wind the clock back. So you're 16. There's no driving license in your family at that point. Did you get a motorbike?
Yeah.
And this was in Tokyo.
So yeah, on the day of my 16th birthday, my target was to get motorbike license, yeah.
And then what, ride to school and back every day or?
You aren't actually allowed to ride to the school, but I did, okay. Yes.
I'm interested that you had an interest in bike racing, but chose cars. Can you tell us a little bit more about why that was the case?
Honestly, seriously, just what I said. For some reason, as a kid, I looked at it and I thought, I guess just generally looking at how much rider uses his body, etc. I didn't know anything about it, but then for some reason, I just came to me naturally that if you are an engineer, then I think you can have a better influence to make the whole thing, car stroke driver, quicker as an engineer than if you are working in motorbike racing. I thought it'd be like a rider's influence dynamics and also what you can do as an engineer might be more like a much more difficult, if you like. So for some reason that came to me and I said, okay, if I'm going to be an engineer, having an influence, how to go quicker, then it's better to be in car racing.
Does Honda have any internships in Japan? Why the move to England? Because surely you could have studied mechanical engineering in Japan.
Yeah, I guess I was impatient because when I thought, okay, this is what I want to do, what's the shortest way to get there? Then of course, then when you study, well, look into it, most of the teams are based in UK and you have to learn to speak English. Then I looked into Japanese university as well, but in Japanese university, first 2 years, even if you enroll into engineering course, it's general studies. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go to university and study what's relevant straight away. So everything made sense for me to come to UK.
You were a very impatient 18-year-old. That's what I'm learning from this so far.
But yeah, I was back then, I was like 14. So even okay. Then I thought, okay, I'm going to still go to high school in Japan because I wanted to play rugby. Rugby was always a part of my childhood. So I still wanted to play rugby for high school.
Oh, what position were you in?
Scrum
rugby?
Half.
Good hands.
I played other positions, but my...
Do you still play rugby now?
No. Last time I played must have been... Well, I don't know, more than 20 years ago. Okay. I broke my shoulder so many times, so it's better to stop.
Okay. So you moved to England.
Yeah.
What was the hardest thing for you to get your head around at that point?
What's the hardest thing? I mean, to start off is because when you are so young, you don't have your certain expectations. Your lifestyle is not completely set. So for me, everything was new and exciting. It's not like I had an expectation my lifestyle should be this. I expect this to be in this way. I didn't have that fixed concept. I came into England really without knowing anything about the country, but everything was new and exciting. So in that way, it was much easier for me to absorb everything and adapt to everything. But I don't know what's the hardest. I guess, for instance, one of the very first incident I had with my host family. In Japan, we don't have sarcasm, right? My landlady was very sarcastic. So after about 6 weeks, I thought she absolutely hated me. So I went to the language school. I think my landlady hates me, so I think we need to find a new host family. And then school said, agreed, okay, fine. Then we decided to move. Then the day I told her, she was so upset because she actually really liked me. And she was just, later I learned that, okay, that's sarcasm. And she was very clever person. And then she was very articulate in her language, but I had no idea how to understand that bit, of course. So yeah, that misunderstanding was one of the first incidents
really,
I had.
Really hard. And yeah. Did Loughborough University, where you were studying, did it have any affiliations with any motorsport teams?
Affiliation, probably not. But the reason I chose Loughborough University was when I was doing a foundation course, I sent a letter to all the Formula One teams and then some like Autosport as well, Motoring News, as many people as I could think of asking which university I should go to. And then kindly those people, most of the people replied to me. And then at least I'd say majority said Loughborough. So I said, okay, this is where I'm going to go then.
So you wrote to the Formula One team saying, I'm not asking for a job, I'm just trying to get the first step up the ladder.
Yeah, exactly. Which university would be the best one to go to? And then honestly, like back in those days, even the technical director, because I just knew the names of technical director, certain people in the teams from reading Autosport, right? I wrote to them and I wrote to the magazine publishers as well. And then most of them kindly replied. Yeah, seriously. So then looking at the replies, Loughborough seems to be a common theme. Then I looked into it. And I went to the open day. I liked the facility. I liked the campus, everything. And then I decided, okay, this is where I'm going to go.
And they probably play rugby there. It's a very sporty university as well.
That was part of the issue.
That was it.
Yes, I was okay in Japan. Never that good, but okay. Then, I went to uni. I didn't know how good Loughborough was. So I went to the freshers' trial. Then because I was fit and I had skills, so I got into the selection match. Then when I played in the selection match, I realized how good they are. My opposition scrum half just absolutely killed me. And then I was in awe. It's like, oh my God, this guy is so good. After the match, I asked him who he plays for. He said, yeah, Wales under 18. Right, not my league then. So I played for uni for a few months and then decided this is just way above me. So I played for the team in the town, which was still good level for me anyway.
I'm maybe putting two and two together and making five here, but doesn't the head of marketing at Haas, didn't he used to work for Bath Rugby or Bristol Rugby? Or...
He used to work for Bath, yeah.
Was it Bath? Okay, so I now know how to get a job at Haas, right? Say I work in a...
But it's a wrong team, though.
Okay.
It should be Northampton Saints.
Okay, all right. Okay, okay.
No, it's just because, again, Loughborough, when I was playing, our first team centre, he was full Irish international, the guy called Jonathan Bell. So back then, he's already played in the World Cup against John Aromu. He was our first team centre. And then at the same time, he was playing for Saints. So I supported Saints ever since.
So do you still have a weekend off, if you get a weekend off as team principal, will you go to Northampton and support?
I love Franklin's Gardens. Yeah, it's a great, great place. Yeah.
Wow. And then whilst at Loughborough, am I right in thinking you then did a year out at Lotus?
Yeah, Lotus Engineering. Yeah. Again, for the placement, I must have applied to minimum 50 companies. And then I only got two interviews. You know, yeah. So one was Lotus Engineering. One was, I think it was Myra. And then luckily, 2 out of 50. And then one interview I had, they gave me a job as a placement. Then, again, luckily, that department I worked in was an active control system. So all the department were in the days of active suspension in Formula One. Those guys who used to do Formula One active suspension, they were in that department. And then I got into basically vehicle dynamics and control by making basically active systems. So that was that I really liked that one. Then I realized, okay, this is the area I want to specialize in.
So in that third year at Loughborough, yeah, at Lotus, were you working with Formula One people?
Ex-Formula One people, yeah. But then that's the day where I think they were in a very good stage with Elise just came out, I think, and they are doing a Esprit V8. And so it was lots of excitement in the place. And also my boss, the guy who hired me, he used to race Formula Ford. And then he actually built his own Formula Ford in his garage. So I was working for him at work. Then in the evenings and weekend, I was working for him in his garage. And then he was running an amateur Formula 3 car. So old Reynard, I think it was 1990 Reynard, the same type as the one Michael Schumacher raced in Macau. So 901B or something, I can't remember the name. But anyway, we had that old Formula 3 car. We used to race in a championship called ARP Formula 3.
I remember
it. Amateur F3 driver. So it was my boss, Steve, and his mate, Bob, who was a good engineer as well. He used to be a chief designer at the Dynamic Suspensions. And then me as like an apprentice with amateur driver. So that was an amazing introduction to actually the practicality of the motor racing.
And that was time spent at the racetrack.
Yeah. So yeah, again, that was actually the first time I was working, you know, in a racetrack in any capacity. So that was so exciting.
Yeah.
That really sort of like formed my foundation, really.
At that moment, it solidified in your mind that you wanted to work in motor racing. That was the defining moment?
No. I think defining moment was already in the late 80s, 88, 89, when I looked at the Senna versus Prost and said I want to work in Formula One. So that was the first defining moment. But the first time I actually worked in a very loose term, because I didn't get paid or anything, it was very amateur scene. The first time I worked in a circuit, I remember still Brands Hatch in the 97. That was the first time I thought, okay, I really want to work on the track side doing this.
Did you meet Takuma Sato?
Not this time, because I met Takuma when I went back to uni the following year. So with my experience at placement at Lotus and both doing a day job and doing this side thing on amateur Formula 3, I really made it clear in mind which area I wanted to be specialized in. So I wanted to do track side. I wanted to focus on vehicle dynamics, performance of the car. So then when I went to uni, I did a certain final year project. But also with that practical experience, it just so it happens when I was in final year, local driver called Angelo Delahanty, he wanted our university department to run his car in a British National Saloon Car Championship. So it's not BTCC, but one below the Saloon Car Championship. So we are looking after his car. Then because I had some track side experience, I could mechanic a little bit, I was doing it. And I just remember one day in Silverstone when I was changing a front anti-roller underneath the car, I looked up and then made eye contact with Takuma, started talking because he's Japanese. We got talking and he said, I'm going to do British Formula 3 next year. Can we do something together? So then next year, I decided to do PhD. So in the first year of PhD, I said to my supervisor, look, I'm writing all these models and simulation tools and then wants to do this optimization. But this guy, I met this guy, he's going to race in British Formula 3. Can I just spend some of my time on the weekend going racing with him so that I can get real data, real feedback, see how this theoretical work I'm doing at PhD can be used or find out limitations as well in the real world. Then my supervisor was so understanding. He said, yeah, okay, I'll pay you a petrol fee. You can do that. So first year PhD, I kind of like split my time in half, half the time at uni, rest of the time going testing and racing with Takuma.
And what were you doing with Takuma? Were you race engineering him?
No. I was just a student with no experience, right? Literally, I didn't get paid or anything. So I didn't have a specific role, but maybe looking at data, gathering tire data from Avon, get the damper data, populating my simulation tools, modeling all the anti-roll bars and everything else on the car, trying to predict and the balance changes, etc., and then providing those information to, race engineers at the time.
So working with Takuma, speaking a little bit of Japanese, how was your English at this point?
At that point, it was okay. I think the most struggle I had was first year at uni. Because when I came to UK, I didn't speak English. I went to language school, fine. 3 months language school, managed to get enough grade to get into foundation course. But foundation course is very small, and it's all, let's say, foreign students. So class is targeted for somebody whose first language is not English. So it was okay. But then going to first year at uni, with full of British people, local people, with the classroom sometimes more than 100 people, that was very difficult.
But I think there is a natural bent in your family for languages, because I read an article the other day about your dad.
Yes.
And I mean, what an amazing man he must have been, because he was a political prisoner of war. Tell me if I'm wrong. And he learned German whilst in prison. Is that right?
Yes, correct. Yeah.
What an extraordinary story. Why did he want to learn German?
Because he was so into Beethoven. Beethoven's life, music resonated to him so much. even when he was a politician. You know, he didn't know anything about music. Again, it was similar to me in the motorsport. He suddenly got into this Beethoven, met Beethoven. I can't remember how, but met Beethoven's music, resonated to him. He wanted to understand more. He was a, let's say, activist against the war. You know, back then, Communist Party was completely illegal. So then he got imprisoned during the war. And then in prison during the war, of course, he's a political prisoner. So he can't read anything political. Then only books he can get was music. Right, because it's not political. So, but then he wasn't allowed any notebook or pencil. So what he told me was he was given a chalk. So he was just writing chalks on the wall, you know, then rubbing it away, writing it again, rubbing it away. Then that's how he learned German.
Wow. Did you grow up with classical music
in
the house? Are you a absolutely. Fan? Can you play any instruments?
I wish. No, I learned piano a little bit, but then after 3 years, I didn't like it anymore. I had enough of it. So then I went on to a different type of music and started playing drums. But yeah, I did grow up when I was a kid with classical music because that's what my dad played or listened all the time. And I've been to so many classical concerts as a kid. Not my choice, but yeah.
How difficult was your dad's life after the war? I mean, I know you were born in the mid-70s, but was life difficult for him given that he was against the war, Communist Party, Imperial Japan?
I think it was most difficult during the war, of course, because the activity he was doing was illegal. And he had a different name. And then somebody wrote a book about him. Then reading that book, it's like, is this really my dad? You know, he had a gun. He was running away from the special police. He was sold by the spy inside the Communist Party. That's why he got arrested, etc. First time I read it, it was like, is this really my dad's story? Because he didn't really talk to me about those, let's say, difficult side. I knew he was a political prisoner. I knew he was against the war. I knew that he didn't trust what the Japanese government was saying. So again, he learned Russian as well. So he realized, okay, what the Japanese government telling him or telling everyone was not right. Then he decided, okay, I should get a bit more information by listening to Russian radio, because he could get a frequency because Russia is close to Japan. So then he learned Russian. Then he listened to Russian radio and trying to get perspective of where the war is going, what Japan's actually doing. So
it's an incredible story. You learning English was always going to happen in terms of...
Yeah. I have to thank my dad for that side of linguistic ability.
Your dad died when you were 19.
Yes.
What would he make of the IO of today?
I'd like to think he's a little bit proud, but then, I wasn't a very, very good kid, if you like, when I was a teenage years. And then, before I could kind of like repay his trust, he passed away. So I have a huge regret in many ways how I was when I was 12, 13, 14. And I'm very, very thankful that, both my mom and dad supported me to come to England to follow, you know, what I wanted to do. But I didn't show much gratitude or gratefulness back then. Then before I could do that, he passed away. So, so that's a huge regret. But hopefully, somewhere he's proud.
Let's talk Formula One. The first team you work for is British American Racing, of course, which then morphed into the Mercedes team of today. How did that opportunity come about?
So when I was finishing PhD, I had a job offer from a company called TRW. That's a consultancy company, because either I was going to do Formula One. This was my main goal. It was very difficult. I couldn't get any offers at all. And then if I wasn't going to do motor racing, from what I learned at Lotus Engineering as well, I wanted to do a development. So wants to write own simulation tools, own control code, but also be able to test drive the car and develop the car by driving it yourself. You can't do that, of course, in Formula One, but you can do that in a passenger car field in that way. So I wanted to do that. Then the TRW gave me a job. So I signed it. But then 1 month after I signed it, their parent company changed. So I got made redundant. So I got paid 3 months, which initially was good because I had a 3 months extra paid period to finish my PhD. Then, of course, then realization comes and I need to get a job, you know. And then I just couldn't find any F1 jobs. Then I went to, because I did a Formula 3 with Trevor, and then Trevor had a link with Colin Kurs. I went to see Colin Kurs in Germany, and he gave me a job as a race engineer in German Formula 3. But then that never...
Can I stop you there? So yeah. This is Trevor Carlin puts you in touch with Colin Kurs. Who did you work with in German Formula 3? Which driver?
And I never did.
Oh,
but then, yeah, Trevor said, go and see Colin Kurs possibly. So I went to see Colin Kurs and he gave me a job as a race engineer. I can't remember which driver I was going to be a race engineer for. I just can't remember. But then that never sit very well with me to work for Colin Kurs, really. So I came back and then went into research office, really thinking, do I really want to leave England and work for Colin Kurs? You know, it's a race engineering F3, it's an interesting job, but environment never seemed right to me. So I was in a dilemma. Then, as it happens, Takuma on the instant called me saying, how is it going? Have you got a job yet? I said, yeah, I got just a job offer. Then I'm not sure what to do with it. And he said, can you still back out of it? He said, yeah, possibly I can. And then Takuma said, can you go and see Mr. Tanaka-san at the HRD? He's interested in talking to you. I said, of course. They went to see Tanaka-san. And then went well, so Otmar went well, and then initially HRD gave me the job. And then, of course, then I was based in BR Honda, Blackley side. But yeah, the HRD was the, thanks to Takuma, was the first doorway to the
And
F1.
So on a day-to-day level,
yeah.
What was the job?
So that job, so I was in the vehicle dynamics department because of my experience. So mainly I was with the test teams. I went to every single test. And then back then, you know, it was full in-season testing. Now we are testing development parts at every single test. So I was really looking after that side analysis. So the thing I've been doing through Lotus Engineering, through the final year, through PhD, so it was directly relevant. So that was really exciting. And of course, it was track side as well. In a test team, so that was a great learning environment.
So you were working with Jacques Villeneuve,
yes.
Jenson Button,
yeah.
Patrick Lemarier, is that right? The test driver, Ant Davidson, was he?
Yeah, Anthony was there as well. Yeah, again, Anthony, I worked with him in Formula 3 as well, right? You know, first year was Takuma and Ben Collins, and then second year was Takuma and Anthony. Then in BR Honda, I ended up working again with both Takuma and Anthony.
Given the links with Takuma, was it hard for you to leave the team and go to Enstone, go to Renault?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so because I did a couple of years as vehicle dynamicist in general, and then last year at BR, so 2005, I was asked to focus on the tires, which I really, really enjoyed. In the tire war era, that was a huge performance differentiator. So I really enjoyed that one. Then when Bruno contacted me to do the same job at the works team, which is also winning as well. It was just too much of an exciting opportunity to turn it down.
Oh, there'll be a lot of people listening to this, watching this, who go, tire war?
Yeah.
What's that? You know, all the new fans. Just can you just tell us a little bit more about what it was like to turn up at every race with a new compound and the ferocity, really, of the tire war?
No, it was amazing because, again, like we were testing at every other weeks, right? So it's a race test, race test, race test. And then we used to go to various different circuits in Europe, depending on the severity of the tires we're testing. So, for instance, if you're testing the tires for Suzuka, Silverstone, high demanding, hard compounds, we used to go to places like Mugello in Italy, which is very high speed, flowing, high demanding circuit. And then you start with day one, basically mixture of compounds and casing. But you'd be testing like 30 sets of tires.
30?
Yeah, it's all short runs just to see, you know, if any of these compounds are anywhere close to being taken seriously. So first phase of the testing is short runs to basically filter out, let's say, bad ones and then select several tires, either compounds or casing for the long run. Then long run evaluation is really when you decide, okay, which compound and casing you're going to take to the race. And it's just the performance, amount of performance you can find on tires or actually lose on tires is massive. So much bigger than any aero development you can have. So it was huge. And it was exciting to be able to influence race weekend that much, you know.
So you were influencing it as the engineer. How important was driver feedback back then?
Oh, huge. Absolutely huge. Obviously, I was focused on data analysis, but tire is such a complicated thing where I don't know, difficult to say on a percentage. From the data, maybe you can understand 20% of it. everything else is something like it's just not easily shown on the data. And then the driver feel is absolutely critical. And then in BR Honda, so last year I was there as a tire engineer, I was testing with Jenson Button. Then, of course, Jason was a very, very good driver. But then even then, I kind of like went into the limitation of the driver, if you like. But when I then moved to Renault with tire testing with Fernando Alonso, that was complete eye-opener, absolutely another level, incredible.
So Alonso at a different level to Button in terms of his feedback?
In terms of his feel, yeah, feedback also, but in terms of his feel, you know, what he needs to do in, let's say, first five laps to make tire behave in certain way on lap 20. So let's say we used to give a target stint length, right? Okay, for this compound, for this race, at this circuit, we need to do, let's say, 20 laps on these tires, but for the last five laps, lap 15 to lap 20, we want to be able to increase the lap time by this much, and on the in-lap, tire needs to be completely finished, right? But when we are testing with Jenson, again, nothing against Jenson, hopefully people don't take it in a wrong way, but Jenson would find it a bit difficult to completely hit the target, if you like. Either he leaves it a bit too much, so on the in-lap, tire was still too good, if you like. That means you haven't used everything up, or you use a bit too early, so on the one lap or two laps before the end of the stint, tires are really dying. Whereas Fernando, you give him that target, absolutely bang on. It is amazing, like, how he knows, okay, if tire feels this way on lap two, lap three, lap four, I need to drive in this way, take out this much, then I'd have exactly the performance of 20 laps.
So Alonso could deliver exactly what you, the engineer, wanted.
Yeah, absolutely. It was complete eye-opener, incredible.
Wow.
Then I thought, okay, this is why this guy's world champion.
Yeah, and he was world champion at the time when you turned up, wasn't he? Is Alonso the most impressive driver you've worked with? You've worked with lots.
Yeah, Fernando, definitely the most impressive, but also Robert Kubica, even though I only worked with him for 1 year, it was totally clear he was something special.
What stood out about Kubica?
Kubica, just his ability and his focus. I can't remember in detail, but I remember thinking, wow, this guy's going to be world champion.
There's a relentlessness to Robert.
Yeah.
He was the sort of guy who, I imagine, the first thing he thought of when he woke up in the morning was Formula One. And the last thing he thought of before he went to sleep was Formula One.
I remember we were in Monaco back then. We used to run on Thursday. Then Friday was day off for driver. Then we ran on Saturday. Then Friday, normally, driver only comes in for half an hour, 1 hour to catch up with engineers. But I remember Robert, he was in our engineering truck all day. I remember saying to Robert, do you not have anywhere else to go? And then Robert said, no, I'm not interested. I'm just interested in this.
Going through the data, just trying to think of ways to
exactly.
be fast.
Like you said, the first thing he thought of when he woke up was how to go quicker the following day, right? And then that's all he cared about. Apart from only the sort of like outside interest he had was his poker club with Fernando and a few other drivers. Other than that, poker or just F1?
I would love to be a fly on the wall in that poker game. Alonso's got quick hands. Have you seen the card tricks?
No.
Oh, okay, he's got quick hands.
Right.
I think my money's with Fernando on that one. But do you remember Abu Dhabi 2010? I think you had Petrov in your car.
Yeah.
Alonso stuck behind.
Yeah.
Can you remember that race and what was unfolding and the magnitude of the story that was happening? And of course, Vettel steals the championship on the last lap.
Yeah. But to be honest, I didn't care, you know, because I was Vittori's race engineer. We were doing our own race. It's up to Ferrari to do their race. And if they didn't pit stop Fernando at the right time and got stuck behind us, it's not my problem. Then I remember some people, even the journalist, complained to me afterwards, even a year later, what happened last year here in Abu Dhabi is not acceptable. It's like, it's not acceptable. It's not my problem, right? I work for Renault F1 team. I work for the best interest of the team. My driver is Vittori. What happens with Ferrari and Fernando is not my problem, you know?
We're recording this in Melbourne, of course, the race before Japan. And Petrov did get on the podium here. How good was he? I mean, he had his good days and his bad days. We all know that. But how good was he when he was good?
I think he had amazing reaction. You know, he didn't have great feel of the car because I guess he didn't come from the normal background of go-karting. And he used to race Lada in Russia. So he had a very unusual upbringing, if you like. So his feeling in the car wasn't great, I don't think, and he was pretty aggressive, but his reaction was incredible. So even though he couldn't feel what's going on in the car, he can save it. You know, so and also his start, I don't know if you remember any of this, his start was incredible.
It's a quick reaction. He's all about reactions by this.
Yeah, and he was a good fighter in that instant. When everything falls into pieces, he can be quick, but it's very difficult for him to be consistent and understand what's going on. And in terms of racecraft as well, he struggled a bit. But yeah, he had some incredible natural ability in some sense.
And it was at Renault Lotus that you first came into contact with Romain Grosjean. There was a lovely moment in Bahrain, actually, earlier this year when I saw you and Kevin Magnussen and Romain together in the Haas hospitality area getting a photograph, because you guys did so many races together.
But
let's talk a little bit about Romain. And I think a lot of people listening, watching to this will think Bahrain 2020. Let's start with that race.
Okay.
What are your memories of what was just an horrific moment?
Initially I couldn't accept in my head that it's actually Romain in the fireball. I didn't see initially that he got out. Somebody else told me he's out. Then I saw on the footage that he managed to get out. But then until I actually went to see him in the medical center, somehow I just couldn't believe he got out okay. I just remember after the race when the car came, or the remaining came back, it's just the smell of it. It's just horrifying. It just never goes away. I think Kevin was the same in the sense that he couldn't believe he's alive. So after the race, me and Kevin wanted to actually see him in hospital to almost make us believe that he's actually alive and he's okay. So went to see him after the race in hospital, and it was great to see him smiling.
How was he?
Well, when I saw him, he was fine. He was absolutely fine considering what happened. It was just, emotion was just a huge, huge relief that he's okay, he's smiling, his family's on the way.
You talk about the smell of the car when it came back. Can you remember what it smelt like?
It's just the smell of the Vuitton, you know, the burnt smell of a Vuitton, just horrible. And of course, the car's covered with the extinguisher. It just both looks and smell of it, I think it just never goes away. I just, looking at that car or remaining of it, you wouldn't believe somebody came out of that alive. No way. And his shoe, left shoe, was still stuck in there.
The shoe was still in the car?
Yeah, stuck in between the chassis and the pedal.
Romain always struck me as quite an emotional driver.
Yes.
Is that a fair comment, first
of all?
Yeah,
absolutely, yeah.
And when he was on, he was as quick as anyone.
Absolutely. It was amazing. Amazing natural talent and speed. He was so quick, and he didn't need many laps to get up to speed whatsoever. Any circuit, any new circuit he goes to by lap three, he's on there. He's incredible talent.
I remember his first ever race in Formula One when he was Alonso's teammate at Renault at Valencia.
Yes.
I don't know why I've got this ingrained on my brain, but he was only 0.3 off Alonso in qualifying in his first ever race. That was, I thought, a stunning, that was indicative of what he could do.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, honestly, natural speed is incredible. He's got incredible talent. And then I was actually performance engineer on that car. So I did Romain's every single Formula One race, either as a performance engineer or race engineer or chief race engineer. So I did every single race with him. Only one race I missed was Malaysia when I was his race engineer, because my wife had a first child or was having a first child. So I had to fly back. But apart from that one race, I did every single race with Romain. But I remember that Valencia, I was really impressed that this guy's got huge potential.
How did he improve, evolve as a driver during the time you spent together?
Obviously, the first year he came back, you know, we had lots of trouble with him, crashing, etc. Then that was mentally very, very tough for him. And also, I was still a relatively young race engineer. So looking back now, I should have dealt with it in a better way as well. So I always feel a bit of regret that I could have done a lot better to help him.
How could you have done it better?
No, it's just like understanding. It's not just as a race engineer, but as a human being. You know, I can't remember how old I was, but back then, just with all the life, because as a race engineer, as I guess my current job as well, you got to use all your life experience, not just experience as an engineer, right, to help that driver who's struggling to basically conduct the opening sequence of the race. It's not just physical, it's mental as well, right? You know, I kept thinking if I had, let's say, 5 more years of experience as a human being, life experience, I could have helped more. But then I spoke to him, Roman, last year, talking about this. Do you know what he said? He was so kind. And he said, look, we grew up together. I didn't want Ayao at that point with 5 more experience. And I was very happy that I had you, Ayao, of that year. Didn't change anything.
Did you know what kind of Romain Grosjean you were going to get when you were just speaking to him over a cup of coffee? Was he quite easy to read in that way? You know, the quick one, the slow one, the emotional one?
And he was never a slow one. He was always a quick one and emotional one. But depends, because he just saw, he's perfectionist as well. And he wants to get there straight away. And when, let's say, FP1 grip level is low, especially like I remember India, you know, first year we went there, grip level was so low. So you got to take more margins, right? But he just couldn't do it. The braking into turn one, I can't remember how many times he actually made it. He was locking up, missing the corner every single time. And then I decided, okay, open up the data against Kimi. And then Kimi's braking early. And okay, Kimi's braking style is very different, but he's a pretty good driver, so it's good reference, right? But he's braking earlier and he's already on the limit. So, Roman, you cannot brake there. But he just kept saying to me, no, I should be able to brake there. I should be able to brake there. Maybe on Saturday, but not Friday, FP1. But he couldn't adjust that bit at that moment. Then had a bit of a meltdown. But then the same guy puts the car on the podium in India. So, yeah, it's just adjusting to that. He sometimes struggled.
And you followed him to Haas in 2016. Was that an easy decision to make?
It's not easy, but then, so Roman signed with Haas, and then Roman said, yeah, why don't you just go and talk with Gunther, see what kind of project this is. And then I didn't take it too seriously because I never seen new team performing, let's say, in a respectable manner. So I wasn't too interested. But then once I spoke with Gunther, I saw this is quite a different project, and then that's got potential. Then the opportunity to work in a new team, to be a part of setting up a new team, doesn't come around every year. So I thought, okay, you know, all the things I think, you know, I was at Enstone for just under 10 years. So there's all sorts of things like I was thinking in my head, like, why do we do certain things in this way? Why can't we not try it this way? Now, of course, there's all sorts of restrictions with the big team. So, okay, I can at least try all these hypotheses in the new team and see if it works or not. At least I can do that with my responsibility. So in the end, it was easy decision. But to get to that stage, of course, I thought about it quite a lot.
And the team scored points, or Grosjean scored points, in 3 of its first Formula One races. It was an extraordinary time.
Here in Haas's first race, yeah. Again, car build was very, very tough because it's the first time, obviously, in a brand new team. And then it was first time for Ferrari to supply customer teams in that way as well. So everything was struggle. I remember leaving car build in Italy to go to Barcelona testing. I was absolutely dead, exhausted, and felt like end of pre-season testing, but then realized we haven't even turned the wheel yet. So that was that level. And then when we finished pre-season testing, we didn't sleep much, got on the plane to come here. And then even then, you know, we didn't have a confidence that we can build a car, 2 cars in time for FP1. So we front loaded. So we didn't sleep much on like Tuesday, Wednesday, and then managed not to break a curfew on Thursday, if I remember correctly. And then, I think if we didn't score points in that race, so many people would have, I think, left the team because it was a barge of basically collapsing.
Yeah, exhaustion.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the feeling was surreal after the race, I guess, scoring points.
Yeah, and also it's interesting in a sense that, of course, as a brand new team, we haven't had much chance to do pit stop practice either, because we are up against everything just to build a car to get the car running. So during the weekend as well, we haven't had any pit stop practice, if I remember correctly. So we are dreading it in the race to do the first pit stop live. Then, of course, we didn't have to do a pit stop. It was red flag. We changed tire and the red flag. So then scored points.
It was meant to be. Do you know, you mentioned pit stops because I was going to ask you about... Yeah.
I shouldn't have mentioned it.
Yeah. 2 years later.
Yeah.
what were you running? Fourth and fifth, I think it was.
Yeah.
And then the pit stops happened. And was it the same issue with both cars?
Yes, that same issue. Yeah.
How painful?
Beyond words. I just couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe what just happened. Not only one car, both cars, one after another. And then that was, we are looking at the Haas's strongest race results, and they completely destroyed it.
But it wasn't all bad in 2018, because of course the car was competitive. Yeah. You finished fifth in the Constructors' Championship. Did that create a full sense of expectation within the team? As brilliant as it was to finish fifth, did Gene Haas start thinking, hang on a minute, we can go even better than this?
I don't think it's like a false expectation, but then, yes, Gene thought we can do better. I don't think that within itself is a wrong thing to think, obviously. And then 2019, I remember our launch car was okay. Then Gene did put a lot more money into the team in 19, but as a team, we really failed to use that Gene's investment correctly. And then upgrade we are putting on the car wasn't working, and then we didn't react quick enough to rectify that. So yeah, 19 was a bit of a disaster in that sense.
Let's fast forward to the present day.
Yeah.
Ayo Komatsu team principal. When this comes out, you're pretty much 100 days into the new job. What would you say has been your biggest achievement so far?
I don't know. I don't think I've achieved anything. So I don't think there's any biggest achievement. If anything, I'm just really happy with the reaction I got from everyone in the team. So when this news was announced, I went to talk with our managers and everybody in the team, did as many one-to-one as possible, just trying to sit down, talk with them honestly, transparently, openly. And 90% of people see this as an opportunity to improve. And then we are all aligned in the sense of like, well, how we want to improve this team, how we want to go about it. So I'm just overwhelmed by the positive support I've got. I'm very, very grateful about that.
In terms of the improvement you talk about, where is your main area of focus at the moment?
At the moment, I'm putting upgrades on the car. But to start off with, our setup is factory in UK, factory in Italy, and headquarters in US. So mainly between UK and Italy, we weren't functioning as a team properly, right? So that was my first main focus.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Just communication, big communication issue, because in Italy, you have a design office and aero department. So they basically design the car, right? And the UK facility is a race team, race engineering, and all the functionality to analyze the performance of the car. And of course, those two groups or those two facilities needs to work together. But that really wasn't happening. So that was my, or still is my main focus, to get these two facilities to work together. It's clear to me that we got good people, you know, good talented people everywhere scattered around, but it wasn't really given a proper framework to work together. So that was my main focus. I'm still working on it, but atmosphere is good and people are working together.
Do you think the two factory setup is sustainable long term? RB have a similar situation with Faenza and the wind tunnel and everything in England, but everyone else is one factory.
I mean, if you had total freedom, would you set up a team in that way? Absolutely not. But, you know, the way we are set up, we, you know, how we could perform from year one of the new team, that's with the contract with Ferrari supply, how we set up as a model. That's working. You know, we can, even though it's not ideal in terms of Italy facility and UK facilities, I can still see that so many things we can improve to make it work. And then so far what's been happening in the last couple of months proves that we can do a lot better. So at the moment, I haven't hit the ceiling of, okay, this is the limit of how we set up. We need to think about how to do it differently. No. So now, you know, once you get to know people really well, remote working, even if it's not 100% ideal, it's fine. But you got to have that foundation of a relationship, respect for each other, understanding of each other, which we are building. I do feel this year we are working much, much better.
What's the job description from Gene? What does he want you to do?
He just wants to improve performance.
Does he care how you do that? Or is he leaving that to you?
He hates wasting money, right? Which is, to be, you know, fair. And then if I'm honest and looking back on the past years, have we been using the money we are given or we are provided wisely? No, some areas, there's lots of areas we can see, we can make improvement, we can improve the time efficiency, we can improve the cost efficiency. So that's what we are tackling at this minute. So again, similar to your question about the setup, you know, I haven't still seen the ceiling of, with the given investment we got, we haven't hit the ceiling yet. So that's what I'm focusing on. And then if we can do that, improve the efficiency, I'm sure performance comes with it.
You're very different to your predecessor in the job, Günther Steiner. And you are now one of 8 former engineers in the role of team principal in Formula One. I'm quite fascinated by that change in direction within the sport. How does your background in engineering help you as a team principal?
It helps a lot. But of course, I am who I am. So I got to play to my strengths. Then I got to be still aware about the things I'm not experienced, the things I'm weak at. But clearly my strengths is my background. And also the fact that I've been with the team since the first year, 2016. So I know everyone. And then I know how our team works, both strengths and weakness. So I can focus on playing to that strengths, how to get strengths out of everyone in this organization. Also, I know that certain things are less than ideal. But then again, I know that people's got ideas. Then for me, my job is to facilitate those ideas and trying to improve on that area as well. So there's many, many things we can do. I think two strengths or benefit in two things. So engineering background, it helps to make certain decisions. And also the fact that I know the team from year one, that helps a lot.
I think you're almost unique as an engineer in your interest in the personal side of empowering people. Would you agree with me?
I don't know if it's unique, but for me, I get enjoyment out of empowering people and then, you know, get best out of them. You know, then for instance, our new technical director, chief designer, deputy chief designer, I was so happy that we promoted internally, because if we haven't got, you know, those talented people internally, if we have to employ everybody externally, one, it's going to take time. Two, then even when this guy turns up, is he going to fit in? Okay. But the fact that it was so obvious we can promote internally means, again, backs up my belief that we got talents in the company, capability in the company. It's a matter of putting the right people in the right place and connecting people, providing environment so that, you know, they can work together and they can do their best. And that moment, honestly, the improvement I'm seeing, I'm really, really happy.
Am I right in thinking that as much as it's all been about engineering for you, was there a period in your life when you thought about journalism? Is that true? Because the interest in people sort of triggered that thought in my mind.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, before I got interested in Formula One, I wanted to become an investigative journalist.
Wow.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm not surprised when I think of your father's background and
yeah, it came from that because my dad was writing books, etc. And then, of course, from a very young age, I was interested in literature, writing stories, etc. So I remember when I was a primary school student, I used to write a story and send it for the competition for the newspapers. And then it's just somebody my dad used to work with in old days. He was working for Asahi Newspaper Company. He did a piece on the investigative journalism, which basically exposed a massive political scandal in Japan back then. And then that led to so many politicians resigning and arrest and everything. Then that was like, wow. This is what I want to do. These are the stories that police doesn't want to touch. Everybody wants to put it under the carpet. This guy exposed it. One reporter, one journalist. And then that completely changed the political landscape in Japan at that point. So that's cool. I want to do that.
My next question was going to be, how do you find navigating the political landscape in Formula One? But I'm guessing you enjoy that side of it.
Of course, I'm learning a lot. You know, I've only just started, but honestly, yes, you say political, but I'm learning a lot. But then one thing is, like, I find so many people still very helpful, you know, other team principals, other senior figures in F1. Whenever I went to talk to them, they've been very, very helpful. Yeah, I'm very grateful about that as well.
I did just want to ask about Magnussen and Hülkenberg.
Okay.
You seem to be getting the best out of them as well. I can't think of two teammates elsewhere on the grid who would have worked so well together or for one another like Magnussen did in Saudi, working for Hülkenberg. How did you get that across the line?
Well, to start off is this year. I mean, they are very engaged. I think that's part of a, let's say, new environment and then communication that making it clear how we're going about going racing this year. And then they, of course, then I made it clear to them, they are the central part of this. And then they are very engaged. And even like pre-season testing, when we said like, oh, we're going to just focus on understanding tire degradation, we're not going to run low fuel whatsoever, they're absolutely fine. So seeing on the timesheet, P90, P20, didn't matter to us, didn't matter to them. We knew what we were doing. And then the fact that they're so engaged that they know how hard it is now to get a point. So, okay, you know, Kevin had a bit of a scrappy race up until that point, you know, having an incident with Albon. I didn't actually know at that point that Kevin overtook Tsunoda going off the track. But then once we knew that we had a 10 seconds penalty for Albon incident, it was totally clear Kevin's not going to score a point. So only chance for us to score a point with Nico. And that was pretty clear. And then gave him instructions. And he knows how tight it is to get a point. And he knows, or both of them know, how important it is for us as a team. So, yeah, perfect job from that point from both of them.
Were you surprised that he managed to pull, what was it, 18 seconds in 12 laps?
Well, we gave him a target lap time initially, which was a bit too quick. And then we needed to go slower. But then if you look at the course layout, you know, sector one is where you can lose all the lap time, which is exactly what Kevin did. And he managed to hit the new target lap time in the 36s. And then Nico's lap time was getting better and better and better. So, yeah, that was a very good teamwork. Mm.
Very well done to you. And is the tyre deg issues of last year, is that a thing of the past now?
You know, previously we had lots of graining issues. This year's tyre compounds are three soft compounds, so that's going to be forefront of our mind. And when we go to Suzuka, Sector 1, high speed, which is not exactly our strengths at this minute, how to manage that. So I wouldn't like to say thing of the past. We need to see after four or five races.
But you're confident?
Yeah, I'm optimistic, but you know, you really need to be realistic and you cannot be complacent. You know, you got to really be on it to make sure we're on top of it.
Well, I'm sure you are. Ayolu, thank you for your time. New for Beyond the Grid this year,
right,
is we have some quick fire questions, which I'm asking everybody.
Right.
Same questions to all. What else are you good at?
What else am I good at? You're suggesting I'm good at my job, by the way. what else am I good at? I like climbing, rock climbing. I don't know if I'm good. I'm, let's say, intermediate.
Do you do that in your spare time?
Try to, yes.
I thought you might say rugby.
Rugby, because I don't play anymore. Oh. And I wasn't very good, honestly. If I was good, I would have made it at least third team at Loughborough. But I wasn't even close to that.
Who else in racing, dead or alive, would you want to be stuck in a lift with?
Stuck in the lift with Roman, I would say.
Why?
Because if he can get out of the burning wreck of the car, we can together get out of the lift situation. And he's a good friend. Mm. So if you're going to be stuck somewhere, you want to be stuck with a good friend.
Who would play you in a film?
Has to be a Japanese guy, doesn't it? Japanese actor I like is the guy called Ryusei Yokohama, but I don't expect you to know this guy.
What films has he been in case anyone wants to Google it?
Recently, I don't know the English title, though. There's a film called Village. Then recent one is about him being a boxer. But he used to be actually a world champion in karate. I think when he was like 13, 14, he was world champion. Because I saw his film where he played a boxer. Then I thought, wow, his movements are really good. And then I searched what he's done when he was a kid. World champion in karate.
Okay, not a surprise.
Yeah.
Who is the coolest person in your address book?
Again, you probably haven't heard of her, the lady called Janja Gambret.
Tell me more.
She's an 8-time world champion climber. She's the best ever climber, sports climber, existed in history.
About your climbing, would you like to climb Everest? Have you climbed Fuji in Japan? Have you done any outdoor climbing?
Yeah, but so climbing places like Fuji is mountaineering. It's not rock climbing.
Okay,
if you go to places like Everest, K2, it's more of a climbing. But what I do is I love to do alpinism, but then I have to accept I might die, right? So I can't do it at this minute. I haven't got time either to acclimatize for 3 months or 6 months. But what I do is indoor climbing gym, bouldering or rope climbing. And then sometimes when I get chance, I go to North Wales or Peak District or Lake District and climb.
It's all in the legs, isn't it, climbing?
No.
Okay.
No.
Oh, I know.
Everything. Yeah. It's upper body strength, legs, balance, and mind. A lot to do with mind. That's why I love about climbing. You have to be calm, 100% focused. If you are slightly distracted, everything goes, all the coordination goes. So it's a very good mental training for me as well.
Sounds like the Formula One pit wall. Look, final one, Ayo. Who would be your first guest if you hosted a podcast?
Probably the same person, Yanya. Because she's, for me, epitome of like, she's got amazing natural talent. You know, before she came to the senior circuit, she won everything. But in 2019, she did a unthinkable of winning every single World Cup competition. Nobody's ever done it before. Nobody ever thought it's possible because climbing is, unlike any other sports, every single problem is very different. So like I said, some problem might be strength, some problem might be more balance, some problem might be more coordination. So it's impossible that one person can win everything. But she's done that in 19. She's then won the Olympic in Tokyo, and then she's qualified for the Paris. So she's just performance in terms of okay, natural ability, but the work ethic, how to get the best performance out of a human being. That's pretty interesting topic that I'm interested in. So yeah, it would be interesting to do a podcast with her.
Yeah, I think you need to get to Paris in the summer. Go and support her. Ayo, it has been a wonderful chat. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure.
What a remarkable story. In all the years I've been hosting F1 Beyond the Grid, there are few conversations that I've enjoyed more than this one, because Ayo's story is unlike anyone else's in Formula One. Determination oozes from every pore in his body, something he's clearly inherited from his father. And all of his life experience combined with engineering know-how will surely make him a great team boss. Ayo, thanks for your time, and I look forward to seeing you at a racetrack again soon. Now, please let me know what you think of this chat with Ayo, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Many of you got in touch after last week's episode with Pat Simmons, and Pat is a living legend in Formula One. And as Tim Field said, so much experience in one man. I loved his analysis of Senna, Schumacher, and Alonso. Thanks for getting in touch, Tim. And well, that's almost it for this week. Please remember that F1 Nation's preview of the Japanese Grand Prix is out now. Damon Hill, Spanish journalist Jesus Balsero, and I discuss all of the big talking points ahead of the race weekend. And of course, I'll be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. Thanks, as ever, for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.